Let's start out just by wrapping up some of the conversation from last week around the question of who do I marry, or who do I decide who to marry was really the question. And where we left off, for if any of you weren't here last week, the summary of that lesson is basically the way that the world approaches dating is that dating is a trial period for marriage, and that the pursuit is of compatibility and intimacy, and you let those things grow or flesh out over time until such time as you realize that they're not there, in which case you rip it apart. And that's why modern dating is like marriage, and modern breakups feel a lot like divorce, because the intimacy has outpaced everything else. The pretending to be married actually does look a lot like marriage in many ways. And so what happens is when there's a breakup, it is, at least internally, a lot like a divorce. And what we talked about was Christian dating, however you want to define that and whatever rules you want to put around it, most of that is wisdom, not law. Christian dating is more about clarity than compatibility. Understanding yourself and understanding this other person to such an extent that you come to learn and recognize what makes a good potential mate for you, and what makes a good potential mate for that person, and whether or not you are that person. And you always let that clarity be the goal. And what will happen is if you're able to do that, the intimacy will lag behind the clarity far enough so that if you find out this is the person that you're going to marry, you don't feel guilt over sin on the intimacy side. And if you find out this is not the person you're going to marry, you don't create the wounds and that terrible ripping apart that happens if the intimacy was out in front. So it's about getting perspective for ourselves, which requires input from other people who are wise that we trust, on what are my big common sins? What are the besetting sins in my life? What are the struggles that I really have as a person that aren't going to go away? And part of what I need in my life in a mate is someone who is compassionate with these things, but who knows it when they see it, and who can call it what it is with love and gentleness and help me become more sanctified. Not somebody who's going to be bitter 2 years down the road that this thing hasn't changed. I just knew that was going to change about you when you grew up. Well, you knew wrong, because most of the time that stuff doesn't happen. So keeping the clarity and the pursuit of clarity, the understanding of oneself and of another person, keeping that to the forefront then allows that intimacy not to be non-existent, and that's the part we're going to start with this morning, but it allows that intimacy to lag far enough behind that it is appropriate, that the level of intimacy is always appropriate. If I didn't put a little bit of finishing comments on the who do I marry discussion this morning, I think you could walk away from last week's teaching and think that my view of choosing a spouse is entirely academic, that really it ought to be done in a spreadsheet with a careful series of questionnaires. And if one can find the personal sins and the personal strengths which are in the highest percentage of alignment, that's a good business plan, and you ought to go to market with that one, right? So this is where a couple things come into play. Romance is a real thing, and it should be. It's a gift of God. The feeling of romance is a good thing. It is a gift of God. And so when I talk about intimacy lagging behind, I do mean lagging behind. I don't mean never being present. Because what we were deciding was, how do I figure out who I could marry, right? Who is a lawful and wise choice? But sometimes, I'm told this happens for people, sometimes you can go through that exercise and there'd be more than one person on that list, right? That there are, in fact, lots of lawful people that we could marry. how do I decide, given lawful options, who I should marry? And this is where you get into the area of Christian wisdom that, in my experience, faithful Christians like the least. The least. Because in all the factors that you could possibly put on the wisdom side of the board, all right, so forget about lawful. We've already done our lawful exercise. We understand it's got to be somebody who's a Christian. It's got to be somebody of similar, you know, that equally yoked concept. We work through that. It's got to be somebody of the opposite sex. It should be, as a matter of wisdom, you know, someone with whom there is, let's call it sin compatible. Right? You know what? That's the short way of saying what I'm talking about, where if my sin that really plagues me is anxiety and worry, that should influence the type of person that I would marry. Because I shouldn't marry somebody who has exactly the same besetting sin. I shouldn't marry someone who's just paralyzed with fear and anxiety, because the two of us are just going to go down in our bunker together, and that's where we're going to live. Right? But I also shouldn't marry someone who is so theologically persnickety that even a hint of anxiety sets them off about faithlessness and godlessness and plagues coming upon our family. Right? This would be wisdom. So this is what I mean by sin compatibility. And a more sanctified person would call that sanctification compatibility. But I call it sin compatibility. So that would be a matter of wisdom. And then counsel from others, right? Because you're getting counsel from others in all the categories about what's lawful and what's not, and you're getting counsel from others in the sin compatibility area. But there's also something just to be said from gut feelings from people who know you well. And maybe they're not great at articulating why this just, I don't know about this. But you want to take that input. That's something that you want to consider. People who know you well are people who could just say, this seems really odd. And that doesn't mean they're right, because every single one of my wife's college friends said no. And they were dumb. So that's something. But all of that was a buildup to this. The other thing on the wisdom list that Christians get really troubled about. What do I want? What do I want? Oh, no, you can't possibly make a sanctified decision if you're taking into account what you want. Yes, actually, you can. You can't do this in isolation. Well, I want this so I don't care if it's an unlawful choice. Well, I want this despite every single other sign of wisdom pointing to the fact that this would be a terrible decision. This doesn't get to stand all by itself, but this matters. And one of the easiest places in decision making for me to defend that it matters is on this one. Who do you want to marry is a really valid criteria to put in the wisdom category here. It matters a lot. And that's where things like that romantic feeling comes into play. Where someone says, you know what, I've dated this guy for, you know, X, blah, blah, blah. This is great, and this is great, and this is great, and this is great. But I really just not that into him. That's great information. That's useful. That's something that you should factor into this. When we make these kinds of decisions, our wants matter. They matter an appropriate proportion of the decision. They matter on one side of the board, the wisdom side, and not the other, the law. But they matter. And then I'm just going to totally change gears and button up one last thing from last week. So can I move away from? All right, the other thing we need to talk about is intimacy. Lagging behind clarity. I can't, because the Bible doesn't, put many rules for you on this. The great news is the Bible's really clear about some important rules around particularly physical intimacy, but all types of intimacy prior to marriage. And we talked about that last week. Sexual intimacy and intimacy that suggests it's going to last forever. Those are reserved for marriage. But then you get into things like, well, that means any physical contact whatsoever. That means any physical thought about the other person whatsoever. Like, you should just imagine that this person whom you're contemplating marrying is actually a robot in a potato sack until the day you get married. And then suddenly it becomes a woman with this womanly form that God has given her, right? That's the way we should think about these things. The problem is Song of Songs blows that out of the water. It just blows it out of the water. So the only thing I would say on this is be really, really careful about making these decisions in your own life, because any decisions about intimacy have lasting consequences. Not necessarily bad ones, but they have consequences, and so we have to be really thoughtful about them. But be really, really, really careful when evaluating the decisions that other people make in their lives about this, because it is perfectly okay. In fact, it is certain that people will draw within the Christian church who love the Lord and want faithful, God-honoring dating lives and faithful, God-honoring marriages will draw different lines about these things and both be pleasing the Lord in the lines that they draw. And some people can draw more rigid, more strict lines and be less pleasing to the Lord because their sin isn't one of sexual intimacy. Their sin is one of pride. It's an ugly sin too. So again, all I'm saying on that one is there are important decisions with consequences, so be careful and be thoughtful, but be extremely gracious when you look at the decisions that other people make. Because I guarantee you, you are not comfortable with the decisions that the male and female character in Song of Songs made. I guarantee you, if that's your teenage child, you are not okay with the decisions they made. I would just wager some money on that. Because they don't get married in that book until three quarters of the way through the book. So all those verses that you're familiar with, the ones that we giggle about with the way they describe various things, all those verses are from a couple that's dating. Oh no, Paul, they were a couple that was courting and engaged. Okay, it was from a couple that wasn't married. Fair enough? All those thoughts, all those descriptions, all that eagerness and anticipation described vividly for the world to see, they weren't married. They were far down the road in clarity, very far in clarity. But they were down the road in some intimacy, lagging behind appropriately, but boy, not where I want my kids to be, right? We've talked the whole time. Physical intimacy is not the only kind of intimacy that can grow over time. So if you felt strongly about it, and if it was a conviction that the two of you shared, physical intimacy could be zero or near zero. But not all types of intimacy could be zero or near zero before you get married, because then you're making a bad choice. Because the finding out if that intimacy can be sparked, and if it is, I'm going to overuse a term here. Don't beat me on the term. If it is life-giving to you, if that person's intimacy and the response they have to your intimacy feeds your soul in some non-salvific way, that's a great sign of a person you should marry. And that can't be confused with, this is what parents mean when we very demeaningly describe to our children the difference between puppy love, which is real, and then something that is even more real. Right? We're talking about that, this idea that there are, from your spouse, intimacy, not just physical, and responses to intimacy, not just physical, that move something inside of us. And that does not happen from a switch that just gets flicked on your wedding night. So as you seek to develop appropriate levels of intimacy that you've agreed upon, lagging behind clarity toward marriage, that can be a really big factor in the want. You know, I just don't feel anything. That's important. Factor that in, right? So let's talk about grace for all the false curses. God created the world with a certain set of ideas and institutions that were harmed by human sin. Marriage is one of those, and childbirth is one of those. So in the world that God created before the fall, He made a perfect someone for everyone else. And there was a one-to-one ratio of perfect. And you didn't have to go look for them, and you didn't have to worry about if they were the right one or the wrong one. So that was good, and it didn't end in divorce. And we're extrapolating here based on what we know about God and the effects of the fall. So when we talk about marriage and singleness, we have to take a little bit of a different perspective because we don't live in a pre-fall world. We live in a post-fall world. So you can't say anymore that marriage is better than singleness. You could say that before the fall because it wasn't a problem. But now you can't. So what we wrestle with is that we still have in us all the problems that marriage was created to solve. Those problems still exist post-fall. There is no man who has everything he needs within himself for fruitful and productive living. There is no woman, likewise, who has that in and of herself. And that was the pre-fall creation of Eve problem that the creation of Eve solved. That problem still exists. So we have this sense within us, culturally and theologically within our traditions, that marriage is better than singleness because it solves that problem, and that problem still exists. And in general, that is true. But there's a couple really important mitigating factors. One is every individual creature is fallen. So you can't say with certainty that putting two heads together is necessarily better than one if both heads are broken. So just in terms of marriage doesn't fully solve the problem because it can't. So that's one reason why you can't say marriage is better than singleness. The other reason, and Paul points this out in the New Testament in a passage that gives a lot of us some heartburn, that's no longer the biggest problem to solve. See, when Adam was created, there wasn't any need for redemption. There really wasn't anything wrong with the world except this one temporary problem that God made temporary on purpose so that he and we would see the problem. Oh, man is not complete in and of himself. He needs woman. That the two forms together represent what is the fullness of humanity. But then came the fall. And now my incompleteness is not the biggest problem the world faces. The biggest problem the world faces is the judgment of God, is the wrath of God against sin. And so, this is why Paul says in the New Testament, not that marriage is bad, not that singleness is better than marriedness, but that the criteria for determining what you ought to do is now a little bit different. Because the biggest problem the world has is it, plural, the whole world, all the people in the world, people all over the world, and the wrath of God. If you are able to avoid, insert long list of temptation and other problems here, and focus yourself on helping the world with that problem, it is better to be single and go tackle that problem. Does that make sense? That's why Paul says what he says in the New Testament. The biggest problem is that people need Christ and people need to know about Christ. And so now, instead of making a decision based on whether or not I am complete, I need to make a decision based on whether or not it helps the name of Christ be proclaimed in the world. if I am single and I am able to live faithfully before God in a way that helps His light shine before men, then it is easier to be committed to all of that in singleness, and I ought to do it. But if in my effort to make God's light shine before men as a single person, I am unable to do that, my passions burn as such that it leads me into what would be sin and what would harm the name of Christ into the world, then you should be married. Because what is most important now is the name of Christ in the world, not you. Is that clear? Because that's a really tricky passage. And I don't mean to say this with pride, because it took me a lot of conversations with a lot of different people, a whole lot smarter than me, to figure that out. But I have heard that passage taught really, really badly. Really badly. Where single people then can feel sanctimonious over married people, which is probably a nice turn of events, since the other 99% of the time married people feel sanctimonious over single people. So I don't mind that part so much. What God says now is, look, it's not that either one of these conditions is better or worse. It's for you, in your life, as an individual, what will produce the best fruit, singleness or marriage? And if singleness will, you are not bound by many of the responsibilities in marriage that divert your time and attention elsewhere. That's what it says. So all of that is to say there is grace for all of the fall's curses. The fact that you, if you're married, are a fallen married person means that you are, by theological categories, a crummy spouse. You're an imperfect spouse because you sin so much. Why do you sin so much? And your spouse has exactly the same problem. So this marriage is not what God created marriage to be. Everybody okay with that? Your marriage is not Adam and Eve's pre-fall marriage. Everybody good with that? There's grace for that. Those of you who are single, there are times when the world and the church will make you feel as if being single is an effect of the curse. It is. Just like being married to a sinner is an effect of the curse. It's just a different effect. And there's grace for that too. So all of us are in the same boat together. We're either married to sinners or we're not married, and we're in that position because of the fall, and there is enough grace for all of it. This is going to be true, not just on marriage, but what we're about to talk about, which is children and having children. So any questions about that? Do we have children? Yet another example of God intending something in a pre-fall world that looks different in a post-fall world, but we typically keep going back to pre-fall texts and saying, oh, absolutely, this is the only way it could possibly be, period. Because after all, I've heard this so many times, the first command God ever gave was to be fruitful. No. The first command God ever gave is not one we have recorded in the Bible, which is to love the Lord God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength. We know that He gave it because of what we see comes later in His walking in the garden with them. The first command that we have on our page is also quickly followed by the second command that He gave, which is to name all of the animals. And I don't really see anybody with a bee in their bonnet about that being the second most important commandment in all of biblical history. So God said it. It's true. It is absolutely true in a pre-fall world. We should be thoughtful in how we talk about it and think about it in a post-fall world. this is one of those times where I have to give full disclosure. I have two extremely close personal situations in my life dealing with this issue. And so I have walked through this by God's grace, not personally, secondhand, but very close. And I have heard so many insensitive and thoughtless comments made in this realm. So much uncareful speech. And you just don't know whose heart you're breaking when you say those things out loud that you didn't think about. So one just kind of general admonition is be thoughtful here. Your situation is not everybody else's situation. And your thing that you see is so clear and so black and white and so obvious, unless it's actually on the law side of the board, is not. So just be careful. Now, what is on the law side of the board? With respect to, do we have children? What's on the law side of the board? God did issue the command to Adam and Eve, a married couple, be fruitful and multiply. And that is not a command that he backed away from after the fall. And so, for married couples, we are to desire children, and we are to produce and or parent children insofar as we're able. And that's where the fall part comes in, and grace for the fall comes, and we'll talk about that. But you cannot escape the fact that a Christian couple who gets married and chooses not to have children for reasons of scheduling priorities or financial cost, or that's not a good choice. That choice lacks wisdom. It's not a law the same way Exodus 20, verse 4 and following are laws. You must do this. It's more like, you know what? I love you. Here, I give this gift to you. And the gifts I give you, and actually, I think even your English translation should have the word and the phrase, and he blessed them, right before this. If somebody's got Genesis 2, you can check on that. I give you this, and then he lists the things that he gives them. And one of them is this ability to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The other is to name all the animals, and then the other is to have dominion over all of the things in the earth. So these are just are realities more than laws. They're realities that he's bestowing upon them. The reality of this world I've created to you because I've blessed it and because I've blessed you is that you will do this. And then here's the list. So in that sense, it's not a law. However, God's realities are good realities. And so if we want to please God, we should want to live within the realities that he creates. So somebody who says, well, I'm allowed to say that I don't want to have any children and, you know, we want to live our lives this certain way because it's not a command, that person doesn't get Hebrew either. Does that make sense? Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. So do we have children? Insofar as we are able, if we are to be married, we are to be mindful of producing and parenting children. We live in a fallen world. We live in a world where some people aren't married as a consequence of the fall because they're able to better shine the light of Christ in the world that way. We live in a world where people are married one sinner to another. Not God's highest and best for marriage, because we live in a fallen world. And we live in a world where people who are married and who live in this reality where it would be better, non-fall, to multiply multiplicitously, make a lot, where that's not always the case. And it's not, I'm not just talking about infertility here. I'm talking about the question of how many and of when. I'm actually going to flip those. Let me start with how many. Now, everybody knows the right answer to how many children should a Christian family have is 3, because that's how many we had, and that's how I judge the rest of you people on your godliness. We laugh, but that's the way a lot of Christians think, or at least talk, right? Is that we made the right decision and you people didn't. You either have too few or too many, because what we have, that's what's right. Or in the case of a couple of my friends, what we have minus one is what would have been right. Nobody actually says that, just so you know. I've never met anybody who said, I wish we had one less kid. I've met 1,000 people who said, I wish I had one more. I'm not one of those people, just for the record. How many? In a pre-fall world, as many as God would give. Is that fair? Because in a pre-fall world, you don't have to deal with the consequences of sin. You don't have to deal with human weakness and human frailty. You can know that everything that God gives is appropriately accounted for and provisioned. It's not that wisdom is less important. It's that wisdom's less difficult in that world because we possess it because we don't have fallen minds. In a post-fall world, the answer's different. It just is. And I would actually argue to you that when you are making these decisions of when and how many, to some extent by any means, but actually let's frame this up real quick. So when we talk about by any means, we're talking about fertility treatments of various kinds. What is on the law side of the board? When it comes to fertility, what's on the law side of the board? What's allowed absolutely or not allowed absolutely? Like black and white, we can't do this. Okay? So we can't have the Abraham, I'll take matters into my own hands and we'll put a baby in this family somehow approach. That's good. That's good. We've read our Bibles. What's another one? We can't end life, and we can't treat life casually. So we can't, and again, we've all made wrong decisions in our lives. We've all sinned knowingly or unknowingly, and there's grace and there's forgiveness for all of it. So if you fall into this camp, please don't feel condemned. But we need to be clear on what the Bible does require of us. We can't put 100 fertilized eggs frozen somewhere and start using them one by one to see what takes. We can't do that. And we can't do that because no matter how much we want to convince ourselves that we would find some way for all of them to be brought through, and we can't control that. And it's not going to happen. And so we don't get to do that. So by any means necessary, no. We can't treat life, human life. We can't treat that casually. We can't be callous to the fact that that is, until God tells us otherwise, He says that He knit us, He formed us in our mother's womb, and that He knew us before that even. So the best biological construct we have for that is a fertilized egg. We don't have the ability scientifically to see any more deeply than that. And so that's the line we have to draw. So we can't have an Abraham and Sarah situation, and we can't treat human life carelessly. Everything else is on the wisdom side. Everything else about fertility treatments is on the wisdom side. So that means everything else is okay all the time, right? No. How many children should we have? Well, as many as God gives us, because that'll be okay, right? No. When you finish reading the very small number of biblical mandates on the law side of the board and you move over to wisdom, I think you will actually find more important texts to help you make these decisions in the texts that are about husbands and wives than you will find about the ones dealing with who should have children, when and where and how many. Because what this becomes in a fallen world, every one of these decisions right here, What these become in a fallen world is an extremely delicate and very important exercise in husbands being husbands. Real husbands. And as countercultural as that runs, these are women's decisions. No, they're not. Because in a godly marriage, husbands, you've probably heard me say this before, husbands have four primary responsibilities. They lead, they protect, they provide, and they teach. It means they're responsible for these things. They're not the only ones who do them. But they're the ones who make decisions about what means are we going to use so that these goals are accomplished. So this doesn't mean, please don't ever interpret this to mean, oh, husbands are the only ones who can have a paycheck. No. But husbands are ultimately responsible for making determinations about what kinds of paychecks are going to come into the house and when at various stages of life. Protection is at the heart of these decisions. Part of what God wired in women to make them mothers, part of what God has given women in the way that they think and in the way that they feel and in the way that they decide that makes them mothers in all of the ways that fathers could not be mothers is exactly what husbands need to protect them from in making some of these decisions. How many? By what means? That's a decision that gets made with a tremendous amount of input from both spouses. But husbands have to take into account the things that they know about their wife, that they believe to be true about their wife, that she would not or could not factor into this decision. Husbands have a responsibility to watch their wives and figure out how their wives will thrive in motherhood. That doesn't mean just the what does she want, because she's wrong a lot about what she wants and what she thinks will work, just like we are. So it can't just mean that. They have to know what sins are being purified and refined in the fire by this, and therefore that's good, like my compulsion for putting things back where they go and labeling stuff. And what sins are not helped by this? What is not an effort in sanctification, but what is simply overwhelming and demoralizing to her? And then I can't say, you know what? This is a woman who is actually at the limit of her post-fall abilities. Not perception, I can't take anymore, but actually, me, outside observer, husband, looking at the situation and making a determination, this is the limit of what is good for you. Take the feedback, take the input, listen. This is where that listening thing husbands are supposed to do matters so much. Listen, but then ultimately make the decision. I would get absolutely run out of the world on a rail if I said this outside of a Sunday school class. And some women in this class may even disagree with me, and that's okay. But I firmly believe that God wired women in such a way that deep down she wants you to own those decisions. She wants to be heard. She wants to have the right amount of input. She wants you to value her wisdom, because in lots of ways around these decisions and others, it's wiser than yours. And so you take all of that in. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about who owns the decision. In a godly marriage, a husband owns the decision. And in a godly marriage, she wants you to. So whether it's a decision about when, work through the decision about when. We have all these competing factors we talk about, right? And a lot of it is valid. There's a financial issue here. There's a housing situation. When you talk about adding more, there's a vehicle situation. We had to buy a different kind of car. There's these things that factor into it. And all of it matters and all of it is real. But at the end of the day, it is the responsibility of a husband to take in all that input and desiring what is best for his wife, to own the decision. Back to dating for just a minute. That's the kind of man you're looking for, is a man who gets that that's what this is about. When the Bible talks about headship, it is not about power. It is not about control. It is not about any of the things that would make headship fun. It's about the ones that make headship not fun, which is owning really, really difficult decisions. And so when it's a question of when, and when it's a question of how many, you take in all of that input, and you observe the lives of others, and you observe her response and his response to the lives of others who've made various decisions, and you have these conversations, and you pray, and you beg God for wisdom, and at the end of the day, you decide. And what's going to happen is there's always going to be good reasons why you should have picked something different. That's the reality. You know, one of the questions was about how do you balance finances, especially with respect to debt, and having children? Carefully. But it's not a black and white, because anybody who tells you, you shouldn't have any kids until you can demonstrate on paper that it's a good business plan, it'll never happen. You'll never have children because you will never have enough, because whatever you think they cost more. And whenever you think they're going to cost it, they cost it sooner. You will never have enough. So on the debt issue, the question for me, if I were counseling a couple on this, the question would not be, how much debt do you have? How much do you make? What's your payoff schedule? I don't care about any of those things. I care about, why are you in debt? And be honest with me, is debt a circumstance of your life, or is it indicative of a problem in your life? Right? Because for some people, they have debt because of the circumstances of life. They went to school and didn't have anybody to help pay for it. Or they went to graduate school or postgraduate. I mean, there's lots of reasons. Or I used to be an idiot and I got a credit card and I spent a whole bunch of money and I was a big stupid idiot and ran up a bunch of bills and now I have those bills. But now I'm not an idiot. And here's how I've demonstrated not being an idiot. And here's, great. That stuff matters. That is so different than, hey, I just think it's cool to buy stuff. Like me some more stuff. Right? No, you should not have children, but that's for different reasons. The person with the whole bunch of debt, yes, you factor it in. Absolutely, it's part of the decision-making matrix. It's part of wisdom, but probably not for the reasons you're thinking, because you're probably thinking it's about, well, we can't afford an extra $486 a month in the budget, because I've calculated that's what it would be. Not the point. Not the point. How many? Well, is that the others? Protect your wife. What does your wife need to thrive? Not what does your wife need to be happy and comfortable. That's different. That doesn't refine sin, right? Because then none of us would have any children, or maybe we'd all have one. Not comfortable. Thrive. Because it's what we don't like about these decisions is that it's a judgment call. And we want desperately, more than anything else, for somebody to take that judgment call out of our hands and just tell us what to do. And that's just not the way life works. That's not the way God does it. So with every child who comes and every child that gets added to our house, as husbands, we are constantly evaluating what is the effect of this dynamic on my family and on my wife in particular. Because yes, children matter. God told us to be fruitful and multiply, and people love to quote that one. But children do not matter to husbands 1/10 as much as wives matter to husbands in the Bible. You guys are great. Now get out of our house and go do something with your life. Right? That's the Bible's attitude toward children. You guys are great. It's a blessing to have you. We want to let God use us to give you wisdom and to help you grow and to find enjoyment in one another and to become friends and then get out. Because this spouse, who's not here today because she's sick, this spouse is the person I picked. This is the one I chose to be with every day, right? So when we make this decision about how many and when, what's best for the whole, but really what's best for my wife, that's what drives that decision. Because the Bible doesn't give black and white answers about how many. The Bible doesn't give us an easy out here. We live in a post-fall world, and we've got to use judgment to make these decisions.